Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. All right, folks, welcome back. And it is now or never. And we've got a lot to cover. As a matter of fact, I really want to focus on covering as much content as we can, because as you can tell, we're doing these game changer episodes as well as some feedback Fridays, because I think it's important to try to cover some of the events that are occurring. And, you know, I know on last Friday, because I was kind of land-based just a little bit over the Easter weekend, and so I have risen from that. Unlike he has risen, because I mean he's risen in all his glory, and myself, well, I'm just still struggling. But the good news is that I promised that we were going to start placing context to the type of president America needs, and I think that is going to be something that's really important that we talk about, because Feedback Friday will really kind of cover some of those things. And I just, as I started covering some other topics, I just went down a few different rat holes. And I don't think I covered what I really need to cover regarding Trump and the importance of what we need for a president to get us out of what Biden has done. I am not convinced, and we'll go through this. I'm not convinced that Trump will actually be able to do what we need him to do. But the question is, you know, how is this public relations going to affect him? And so it all depends on the narrative, and we'll get into that on Feedback Friday. So if you have anything else that you really want me to dive into, just send us a note, send us a voicemail, 425-270-5416, and or a note email to info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. Now, we are going to dive into the Pennsylvania debates. I just want to touch two things real quick. YouTube channel, subscribe. I'm giving Kenny B kind of heads up notice in the next couple of weeks. I'm going to be putting emphasis on him to get these Constitution classes that I did, or these Constitution podcasts that I did, up and loaded. And we're going to start uploading these ratification debates, because we're almost done with Pennsylvania. So that means we've gotten through a good body of Pennsylvania, or I should say ratification debates. And the real good news is we do have Paul Venable back with us to actually start the week off as we get into the content and going through the debates. And so welcome back, Paul.
Hey, thank you, GR. Great to be back.
You know, folks, we really don't have a delay. It's really just more of my age getting to the volumes and everything else here. So anywho, Paul, so one of the things we've been going through, and as a matter of fact, it's worth going into, but I'm really not necessarily prepared. But one of the things I noticed was the fact that they actually recommended an amendment to the Constitution regarding the apportionment of representatives to people. And so I'm making these mental notes so that when I go through some of these First Amendment petitions and creating them, I'm going to have a lot of great reference material coming out of these debates. But anyway, without any further ado, do you have, because last time we talked, we covered a lot of content and material, do you have any saved rounds, any comments that you did get a chance? Because we went straight out to end the show because we ran out of time.
Yeah, we actually bolted right up to the end of the show, and so we didn't have an opportunity to discuss a lot of things. About the apportionment, you mentioned that. It was interesting. Apportionment was discussed at the federal convention, and we had they did something similar. They wanted to start at 30,000, you know, work their way up to 40,000, 50. I believe in this one, they wanted to start at 20,000, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, they wanted to actually, they wanted to bring it down even more, correct, and then ratchet it up. Yes, yep,
Correct.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I think is has been missed and is because in what the American people don't know, because the generations have passed that understood this, is at some point we stopped, without a constitutional amendment, we stopped at 435 members of Congress.
As far as seats go. So in other words, what they did was they built this Capitol, and the Capitol had so much room to grow. And so what they should have done when they started approaching the last 50 seats, they should have started accounting for growing the chambers and how to do that. Now, you know it's a rotunda, right? And so, in other words, it's a round-topped building. So to actually carve out more seats out of a round, because, you know, the structural support for a round rotunda, you know, has to change dramatically if you're going to increase the size of it because it's spherical or what have you. So anyway, it's not square. And it's not like they could actually create two separate wings and kind of divide, you know, parties or what have you. You know, one party goes off and extends into the left side and the other party, you know, which would be which. And so anyway, but what they could have done was they could have actually started accounting for that and created a construction so that they could have gotten certain things done and slowly accounted for the expanse. But they had already come to a comfort level as Congress and as the federal government that they didn't need to worry about complying to the Constitution anymore. That they could use statutes, regulations, acts, resolutions, whatever they wanted to do to, you know, prove that they could assume and make the changes that they wanted to make, because at that point in time, the states had become shills. In other words, the states had kind of lost knowledge of their inheritance. Now, see, this is the interesting thing that I kind of harp on, because the beautiful thing about our system is that it is our government that happens to have the perpetual, you know, life. Because our counties, our states, and our federal government, they constantly live. And it's not like they die off with people. And so they didn't do what they should have done to make sure that, you know, the new generations would learn the important things to build upon them. They allowed themselves to become illiterate and stupid regarding things so that, in other words, it was almost like the formation of the Catholic Church in our government.
Hmm. What do you mean?
In other words, instead of living based on, you know, the fullness of how this government was built and why it was built the way it was, they stopped teaching people about American republicanism or republican form of government and these other things, so that states actually started migrating towards democracies and states started allowing the federal government to go outside of its boundaries. And because they were basically either co-opted by money or convinced by prowess, by jurist prowess, you know, some Supreme Court justice says we can do whatever we want to do, you know, and this is how, and this is why, and, you know, you want to take me on? Because everybody was afraid of, you know, the Supreme Court eventually, because everybody believed that they had these powers that they don't have.
So then what happened is we became comfortable with a level of intergenerational ignorance.
There's that, and that nobody thought that our government would become our greatest enemy.
Right.
Right. nobody thought we would actually turn on ourselves. And so anyway, it's all interesting, but there's, you know, we could have avoided all of this. You know, one of the most important things that would have been integral in avoiding all of this is every time a new state joined the union, they would have received these ratification debates, copies of the ratification debates. And as they do that, you know, the print would have gotten better. I mean, I think it's just actually pathetic. Pathetic that when we look at the congressional record and everything else, it's all images and it's not transposable to, you know, instant text. Every word should be able to be cut and pasted into, you know, any type of academic work instead of having to do, you know, research. I mean, it's one thing if we're researching an ancient society, but this is a current society.
Yeah, I've had some trouble with that recently. I acquired the ratification debates regarding the 14th Amendment, and there is no way that I can digitize it. Yeah. What I figure I'm going to have to do is actually read it and then take it from speech to text. But so one of the projects I have is I'm going to read that and document it. And maybe that's a contribution that I'll make to turn that into speech to text, because I think that's a piece of information that the American people need to know.
Same thing with the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights, you know what? The Bill of Rights is even worse than the 14th Amendment, because at least the 14th Amendment, the quality of the pages is almost a century later. And so the quality of the page is much better. And anyway, so yes, but we digress. Let's go ahead and dive into the Pennsylvania debates. And so I'll go ahead and start off, you know, the reading here. We left off on page 87, and we were kind of in the middle of going through these recommendations. So these are, let me see here. Necessary and proper. Oh, actually, these weren't the recommendations yet. What these this is McCain, and McCain was going through his inordinate, or I should say his comprehensive argument against the list of arguments against the, I'll just say, the anti-federalist. And so this is where he left off. And it says, the president, hey, go ahead.
What? Yeah, you know what? I think we read these.
Okay.
I think we read these because I'm looking down. Remember, we actually got into the amendments. Okay. And as I'm looking at this, I think we've covered this. You know, I think we covered this in our last broadcast.
Oh, you know what? I think you're right. And as a matter of fact, I believe where we left off, so we will be getting into Massachusetts. Good. Because you know what? The jurisdiction amendment, if you've got that one right there, I'll start it off with, because up above, they started talking about the color of law and so forth. And so anyway, this is where we are, and this is one, that Congress shall not exercise any powers whatsoever, but such as are expressly given to that body by the Constitution of the United States, nor shall any authority, power, or jurisdiction be assumed or exercised by the executive or the judiciary departments of the Union under color or pretense of construction. I think this is where we left off.
Right.
And so right, because this is what's jumping out to me. And so, but all the rights of sovereignty, which are not by the said Constitution expressly and plainly vested in the Congress, shall be deemed to remain with and shall be exercised by the several states in the Union according to their respective constitutions, and that every reserve of the rights of individuals made by the several constitutions of the states in the Union to the citizens and the inhabitants of each state, respectively, shall remain inviolate, except so far as they are expressly and manifestly yielded or narrowed by the national constitution. And then they get into Article 1, Section 2, Paragraph 3. Now, so this is where they're actually calling out the part that they want to make an amendment to. So in other words, the Bill of Rights kind of listed the inalienable rights and all of that, but they're actually going through here now. And this is, you're right, this is where we kind of covered this. And I think we need to cover this again because I actually need to highlight some of this stuff. And this is number two, that the number of representatives be, for the present, one for every 20,000 inhabitants. You got that? Are you with me?
I'm there.
Okay. According to the present estimated numbers in the several states, and continue in that proportion until the whole number of representatives shall amount to 200, and then be so proportioned and modified as not to exceed that number until the proportion of one representative for every 30 inhabitants shall amount to the said number of 200. And so this is what I would just say as one of the most illuminating parts of this Constitution, or I should say of the amendments that were recommended, because this right here kind of gives you the origins of the very first amendment. Pennsylvania was the first one to complain that the representation was too watered down with 30,000, that, you know, they needed to hold back until the nation grew more. And, you know, why do you think that is, Paul?
I hear you. I heard the question.
You're just thinking about it. So let me give you my thoughts on why I'm posing this question. Is because I honestly believe that they wanted to make sure that before the people lost or had their representation watered down by apportionment, that enough people would be educated on the system by then. Because as, you know, as we grow into this new government, we would be smarter at that. But actually, I'm just looking at the converse argument. A lot of times when you come up with an argument or a reason why something occurred, like we became more stupid on our government because we just became more trusting of it, instead of actually becoming smarter and wiser by exercising and engaging it. So in other words, I think that there may have been some thought to say, hey, you know, we will be better in engaging government as we learn more about it, when actually I think the nature of man is to be more lazy and apply themselves less if they don't have to. And so, see, I...
So how do you solve that?
Well, so...
That's my question. How do you solve that?
And so the fact of the matter is that... They were trying to create a system that actually did solve the problem, but they really didn't create that system. Or I should say, it took the 14th Amendment to really kind of bring things around. Because the one thing that the 14th Amendment gave us was the ability to hold public servants directly accountable to their oath. In other words, it closed the loop. See, the oath of office was huge. It was a legal binding, you know, process that somebody was now legally bound to support the Constitution. If they did anything other than that, they could be called out for perjury. Well, right. That was based on, and they started playing these games that, well, you can't hold us accountable to that. I mean, you know, we're elected officials and we should be able to have political theater, right? And you know, so the people actually started getting disgusted with the fact that they made themselves above the law. Well, the 14th Amendment actually did fix that. And there were states that actually started putting it into their state constitutions, because it's one thing if the federal government does it, but it's another thing if all of a sudden we see the states allowing it. So with the fact that Missouri and other states actually have it in their constitution, we can actually start exercising and cleaning up states. And it becomes, I think, you know, when you all of a sudden start exercising, you know, some power, some muscle in doing something, next thing you know, you realize, well, you know, this work isn't as hard as we think it is. Wow, you know, because I've got these muscles to do this. I can actually exert my energy that way, and it's not that much exertion. I'm stronger than I think, that type of thing. And so when people actually start holding their public servants accountable, they realize how much easier it is to have the government that we deserve, have the government that we're supposed to have. And so I think that the 14th Amendment, and there was a big enough gap of ignorance and everything else, and maybe defeatism. I mean, maybe the people were completely defeated because they just, you know, did not have control over. But I do see throughout the history, there was cases in time, like right after World War One or Two, I forget what it was, were in, I think it was Tennessee, where a group of men, you know, kind of took back their local government and rose up against, you know, the corruption that was in their state. And so it's not that we don't have the ability to do it, but it really helps when the supreme law of the land gives you the support to do it. And right, that's what we really needed. And so I think that just the disconnect between the original writing and the insertion of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment came late in the stage, that it, you know, it didn't really start really gleaming as the gem that it really is for us today until now.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. So anyway, so Section 3.
So you just got finished reading the Article 1, section.
Yeah, right? Number 2, right. So go ahead and do Section 3, number 3.
Okay. The senators, though chosen for 6 years, shall be liable to be recalled or superseded by other appointments by the respective legislatures of the states at any time. Section 4, number 4. The Congress shall not have power to make or alter regulations concerning the time, place, and manner of electing senators and representatives, except in case of neglect or refusal by the state to make regulations for the purpose, and then only for such time as such neglect or refusal shall continue.
Yes, yes. And I love this because there is this general feeling by Congress or by people in the federal government that they can make these general rules. And we see this today. But they recognized that they needed to really contain the federal government's ability to do it. They recognized possibly the need, if we were in the midst of a war, crisis, or what have you, they needed to do it. But the priority had to be given to the states. And it was only to, you know, persist for a period of time that they couldn't make it permanent law, because that's what Congress is trying to do today. Anyway, go ahead. I'm sorry. Section 8. Paul? Well, I think we...
Hello, I'm here.
Okay.
I'm here.
All right.
I think something... I got a call. I didn't take the call, and I wound up going on mute. So
okay, that's okay. So Section 4... Section 8, verse 5.
Right. Okay?
Okay, go ahead.
That when Congress shall require supplies, which are to be raised by direct taxes, they shall demand from the several states their respective quotas thereof, giving a reasonable time to each state to procure and pay the same. And if any state shall refuse, neglect, or omit to raise and pay the same within such limited time, then Congress shall have power to assess, levy, and collect the quota of such state, together with interest for the same, from the time of such delinquency upon the inhabitants and in estates therein, in such manner as they shall by law direct, provided that no poll tax
be imposed. Yeah, and so, Paul, you don't know it, but we've just now got some music playing, and that means we're going into a hard break. So hey, hold on here, Paul. We will be right back, folks. And we're going to be picking up with Section 8, Part 6, the Standing Army, part of the Article 1, Section 8 powers, or the enumerated powers. And these are recommended amendments, folks, and we'll be right back after this promo. Thank you so much.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so, all right. Sorry for having to go into the hard break. I saw we were going to have this kind of a little bit of a collision regarding the outgo, that you'd just barely make it in time. But anyway, so here we are. We're now going into Section 8, Subsection 7 regarding, or actually, no, Subsection 6 regarding standing armies. So go ahead and take it off, pick it up from right there, Paul, if you could. Thank you. Okay, so we're having more technical difficulties. Paul, are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you.
Okay.
I'm with you.
All right. Okay. So go ahead and pick it up from there.
All right. Just a minute, GR.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I'll kick start it. Section 8, you, subsection that, yeah. 7, that no standing army of regular troops shall be raised or kept up in time of peace without the consent of two-thirds of both House of Congress. So this was an amendment that they wanted to make sure that not only did it require two-thirds of both houses of Congress to send us to war, but that it required each time if they're going to maintain a standing army. I mean, folks, when you go through the ratification debates, it's really, really clear they did not want the federal government to be able to host an army that they could send around the nation and enforce their own laws. Because remember that the standing army was the federalized militia. So the next one is regarding the exclusive legislation amendment, which is Section 8, and it's basically subsection 7. The clause respecting the exclusive legislation over a district not exceeding 10 miles square be qualified by proviso that such right of legislation extend only to such regulations as respect the police and the good order thereof. So in other words, the basic law enforcement for the small district of Columbia. Because, you know, the exclusive legislation over the District of Columbia granted them literally, you know, all sorts of abilities. I mean, anything that they wanted to do. And so they said, you know what, we think that we just need to keep this to the, you know, the maintenance of good order and policing, and that's it. And yeah. So they wanted to actually contain that the exclusive legislation more. Go ahead.
Now, there's a question here. As they're speaking of this exclusive legislation over district not exceeding 10 miles square, this district doesn't yet exist.
Right.
In other words, they determined there's going to be a district for the federal government that is outside the boundaries of any state.
Right. Right.
Okay.
And in Section 8 of Article 1, it grants the federal government to create such a district, providing that the states accede that much territory. I mean, you know, not exceeding. So the state could have actually only given them, you know, an acre or two, you know, right. And another state could have given them an acre or two instead of, you know, 10 nautical miles square, mm-hmm. which is what they ended up getting. Because, you know, we were land rich back then. There was plenty of land to roam around. And so anyway, I think they overdid it.
Okay. But by the way,
go ahead.
You use the term nautical. Why did you do that?
Because if you really look at the 10-mile square, they were actually using nautical miles, not statute miles.
Okay. So the actual size turns out to be 10 nautical miles square.
Yes. Yeah, the statute mile became, because in those days it was, so a statute mile is shorter than a nautical mile. A nautical mile is one, if I'm correct, it is in latitude, you know, lats lie flat, and longitudes, they go up and down on the globe.
Right.
The consistency in latitude is between 1 degree and the next degree is 60 nautical miles. And then okay. So I think a minute, or is it a minute or a second, is a nautical mile. So anyway, it breaks down by nautical miles. The smallest increment is probably going to be a second, which would be 1 nautical mile. And then if you add up, you know, the circumference of the Earth, it'll total up to that very specific nautical miles. But anyway, okay. Yeah, so they actually used nautical miles in creating it. But it doesn't state nautical or statute. It just says not to exceed 10 miles square.
Okay.
Okay, that's all.
Yep.
All right, so anyway. Forgive me, folks. It was just a little glimpse of a technicality that, yeah, I mean, people don't even know that there's a difference between a nautical mile and a statute mile. Anyway, that's my upbringing in the intelligence community and understanding all that type of stuff. So forgive me. The militia, go ahead. Section 8.
Okay. Section 8, number 8.
Yes.
That each state respectively shall have power to provide for organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia thereof, whensoever Congress shall omit or neglect to provide for the same. That the militia shall not be subject to martial law, but when in actual service in the time of war, invasion, or rebellion, and when not in the actual service of the United States, shall be subject to such fines, penalties, and punishments only as shall be directed or inflicted by the laws of its own state. Nor shall the militia of any state be continued in actual service longer than 2 months under any call of Congress without the consent of the legislature of such state or in their recess the executive authority thereof.
Yeah, so, you know, this is interesting. So I'm going to add something to this because people have a hard time understanding this. And they actually have what we call martial law for the military today. While a person is in service, they no longer have their civil rights. You don't have the right to say what you want to say. You don't have the right to do what you want to do. Your body and soul and life belongs to the United States if you are in the U.S. military. And so they have a completely different legal code and is called the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And so when we go into war, combat, or into an area of hostility, the military has this ability to create rules of engagements and start creating, you know, all sorts of legal parameters. Okay, if they look at you crosswise, you can blow them up. But if they smile, you got to wave back. You know, those types of things. And it gets, and actually, it's gotten so ridiculous that the military has really had just a hard time with the civil commands. Let me back up because I'm going down a rat hole, but it's worth really going through because you hear the military complain about bureaucrats and lawyers controlling the battlefield. Well, you got to remember that during George Washington's, you know, time and for years and years and years, when the military deployed, they were completely under the thumb of that military commander. Well, government as we started growing, you know, in every war and engagement that we had, the president had this desire to have better control because, you know, they were out there prosecuting a war under him and under the name of the United States. And so they wanted to have better control over that, and better command and control started coming in when technology started coming in to where the commander in chief could actually communicate to his generals and eventually started being able to communicate to the people on the front lines. So in other words, what ended up happening is technology started breaking down the chain of command and the delegation of authorities because the command, I should say, the lawyers and the politicians and bureaucrats wanted to create conditions to say you need our approval, which basically circumvented the chain of command in giving, you know, these company commanders. Now they had to have, you know, contact with the lawyers to say, can we do this? And this is how ridiculous it got, because this is what it's all about, control, where our government and politicians really started controlling almost every little aspect of the battlefield when it turned into the ridiculous, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yep.
And yes. So what they're trying to do, because you'll notice throughout the whole desire by the ratification debates and by the desire of our framers was that there, you know, that whenever military was deployed in the United States, it would always be under civil control. Well, yeah, because we wanted to make sure that the military couldn't override the state governor, the mayor of the town, or what have you, that the civil authority always had, you know, greater power than the military. Because they knew what would happen if the military didn't have to listen, they would just blow everybody up, kill everybody, and take names later. And so they wanted to maintain the protection of the people because, you know, they don't know who these guys are. They could have come from Maine, you know, and they're down here in Kentucky, and they, you know, they're completely different people because they were, you know, we were that diverse. And so there was all of these types of concerns. And, you know, I think most people don't see, you know, how we went from this paradigm of the framers into this new paradigm where it really became problematic because our world got smaller and the bureaucrats started seizing more and more control. And this is how people, troops were dying. They were putting themselves in, you know, in really dangerous situations where a lawyer would say, no, don't. And somebody would actually die because they couldn't respond. And so anyway, there was this growth of hate and animosity towards this, you know, overreach of government going into the military when they're in foreign lands prosecuting a war. But anyway, sorry for digressing. I'm just speaking and ranting a little bit on this aspect, but it's kind of interesting just giving you how we kind of have gone full circle on this. So anyway, Section 9, the Ninth Amendment. Go ahead.
The clause respecting vessels bound to or from any one of the states be explained.
Uh-huh. Okay, so if you look at Section 9 of Article 1, now, if I remember correctly, actually, because they're saying Section 9, so this has got to be Article 1, and that the clause respecting vessels bound to or from any one of the states, bound to or from of the states, be explained. I'm going to presume that what they're talking about, because they didn't get into the details right here. This is just the amendment itself. I think that they're basically, you know, wanting to make sure that the federal government, because what is Section 9? It's the restrictions placed upon the states, right?
Correct.
My bad. The restrictions placed upon the federal government. And so if you look at in Section 9, you know, there may be this clause of regulations and or, you know, how the government can't, you know, get involved in, you know, these treaties. We'd have to actually open it up. But anyway, this is kind of a unique clause that they wanted to create a better restriction on the federal government, because Section 9 is the restrictions on the federal government. It's Section 10 that creates restrictions on the states.
Yeah, so, my bad too.
Okay, so Article 3, Section 1. Now, this is about the judiciary. So this one amendment is found in Section 1. And go ahead.
All right. That Congress establish no other court than the Supreme Court, except such as shall be necessary for determining causes of admiralty jurisdiction.
Okay. So, in other words, they're trying to constrain the jurisdiction and the size of the court to only be limited to the Supreme Court, that only the Supreme Court would have the ability to determine the causes of admiralty jurisdiction. Okay, so Section 2, Paragraph 2.
Number 11.
Yeah.
Okay. Section 2, Paragraph 2, Number 11. That a proviso be added at the end of the second clause of the second section of the third article to the following effect, viz., provided that such appellate jurisdiction in all cases of common law cognizance be by writ of error and confined to matters of law only, and that no such writ of error shall be admitted except in revenue cases unless the matter in controversy exceeded the value of $3,000.
Now, I'm glad that that's not the case. But I think the one thing we can garner and walk away from is that they recognize the lack of discussion of common law, and that they wanted to constrain the federal government from being able to step on the common law and its role in the state's justice system. Okay, so go ahead. Article 6, Paragraph 2.
Article 6, Paragraph 2, Number 12. That to Article 6, Clause 2, be added the following proviso, viz., provided always that no treaty which shall hereafter be made shall be deemed or construed to alter or affect any law of the United States or of any particular state until such treaty shall have been laid before and assented to by the House of Representatives in Congress.
Right. And so even though you can tell that the states were really trying to protect their sovereignty, even though they had representation in the Senate, they weren't happy that the Senate could actually, by two-thirds, make a treaty constitutional without going back to the states. So, in other words, they still wanted the states to be able to say yes. And that's And in some respects, you know, these things never actually took, because some of these things just didn't make sense. Because what about a treaty regarding war? You know, because it, you know, they can't necessarily share those treaties with the states. It would have just taken too long to try to resolve to end a war. Anyway.
Correct.
Anyway. So okay. Resolved that the foregoing proceedings be committed to the chairman for publication. And there we go, folks. That closes out the Pennsylvania ratification debates. Now, which means that we get to start with, today, we're starting with the Massachusetts ratification debates. And we just happen to have, because we're kind of prepared for this, we happen to have this open. And even though I started off, you know, in the wrong spot on the Pennsylvania debates, we kind of recovered some stuff. But more importantly, I want to cover the very beginning of the Massachusetts debates. This is kind of the procedural stuff. But what I want to share with you is the fact that they didn't include everything in these documents. Now, they were creating lots of documents. And I believe that some of the documents that they were creating were never visible in these documents. And in other words, some of the stuff that they covered, because these men were, you know, working out procedures and so forth, and we saw some glimpse of that in the Pennsylvania debates. But in the Massachusetts debates, I don't think that there's any evidence of the fact that they actually debated whether the commission actually exceeded their authority or not. But I don't remember that there is. But what I want to do is I want to go through this because Paula Mayer, in her book, The Seek of the Bill of Rights, or Madison's Pursuit in Seeking the Bill of Rights, she points out to historical documents that in every one of the debates that were vigorously debated, that they actually had a vote to determine whether these men exceeded their commission or not. And so I need to find that citation so I can actually share that with you. So it's my charge to do that between now and before the debates are over. But I do know that we do find evidence within the debates where they do talk about the fact that they already resolved that issue. Now, in her book, she talks about how, you know, the proceedings, you know, because when you look at these ratification debates, they convened on a very specific day. They really didn't start debating until a week later. Well, why? What were they doing for a week? It wasn't that they were all sharing recipes. It was because they were all arguing over why they were there. And you got to remember, in these heated debates of these states that had these cabals were very serious. And it's almost like what we see today in the political warfare, how each of the parties are going after each other, wanting to, you know, drag him into court and hold this guy accountable where, you know, and this is a perfect case. I'll just segue really quick. The fact that they're actually going after Trump for paying hush money to what's her name, but you know, Bill Clinton did the exact same thing with some of the girls that he paid hush money to, and they never trifled over that. And so this is how petty we have gotten when we really start looking. And I truly believe that we're a nation of laws and that we need to follow the laws, but we can't apply the law inconsistently. I think we need to apply the law, and I think we need to go back to Clinton. I think we need to go back to every president and apply the law fully. I'm okay with Trump having the laws applied fully to him, but we can't not do this to Clinton and Carter and the rest of these guys, the rest of these scoundrels. But anyway, I digress, and I've really eaten up some time here, Paul, with this rat hole. In convention, Boston, January 9th, 1788, and I'll go ahead and start this. On motion ordered that the Honorable Nathaniel Gorham, yeah, John Carnes, Esquire, David Charles Jarvis, and the Honorable Tristram Dalton, and the Honorable Walter Spooner, and the Honorable Caleb Davis, and the Honorable John Taylor be a committee to receive the returns of the several towns. In other words, they're already organizing themselves to get the votes of, you know, who was being elected and so forth. And then ordered that a committee of five persons be appointed to collect, count, and sort the votes for a secretary, and the Honorable Caleb Davis, Tristram Dalton, Aaron Wood, Eliezer, something like that, Brooks, and Charles Turner, Esquires, were appointed. So, in other words, they're getting into the proceedings of how things were voted and who was going to become what and how everything was going to lay out. And ultimately, John Hancock became the president of this, of the debates. And so, anyway, then they go into the convention, then proceeded to the choice of a secretary by ballot and the votes being taken and blah, blah, blah. Voted that Mr. Jacob Coon, the messenger of the general court, be appointed messenger to this convention. In other words, they appointed somebody to just go off and send, you know, hey, you know, because they didn't have telephones. They had to have somebody that actually was going to do, you know, do errands. And one of the things I do remember is Eldridge Gerry was not invited. He was not elected. And the anti-federalists said, hey, we want to have them. And so they used the messenger to go get Eldridge Gerry to show up. Anyway, so going on, that they voted, these other, you know, other people voted that a committee of seven be appointed to prepare rules and orders. And in the afternoon, the convention proceeded to the choice of president by ballot, and His Excellency John Hancock was chosen. voted that the convention proceeded by the choice of vice president, and then the Honorable William Cushing was chosen. And, you know, just remember, folks, Samuel Adams was in the room. And so as much as many people look at Samuel Adams today as such a hero, you know, not that he wasn't respected, but look, I mean, Hancock and I forgot the guy's name here, Cushing. You know, here these guys were, you know, were that much more popular. Just to show you how things have kind of morphed. And sometimes I think it's really the rhetoric that we get from people, or the hyperbole that we may get in what they say, that actually helps elevate them down the road. But anyway, that a committee of five be appointed to wait upon His Excellency and acquaint him with the convention have been made of choice for him for their president, and request His Excellency's acceptance of that appointment. On the motion, the Honorable Mr. Adams voted that the convention will attend morning prayers daily, and that the gentlemen of the clergy of every denomination be requested to officiate in turn, that the members of Boston were appointed to wait upon them and acquaint them thereof. A vote of the church in Brattle Street in Boston offered the use. You know, people talk about a separation of church and state. I'm just pointing you out here, folks. Life was a lot different back then. The use of their meeting house and the convention be communicated to the Honorable Mr. Bowdoin, voted that a committee of nine be appointed to view the accommodations of the said meeting house and report. Mr. Sedgwick, Mr. Lincoln, Mr. Taylor, General Brooks of Lincoln, Dr. Jarvis, Dr. Holton, Mr. Strong, and Mr. Nason, and Mr. Thatcher were then appointed on the said committees. And now, so now we've gotten into the next day, the third day, Thursday, or the fourth day, January 10th, the committee appointed to examine the returns of delegates desired a rule whereby they might determine whether the towns had exceeded their privilege to send members. After a long debate motion was made, the valuation of the different towns returned in 1784 should be the rule to determine the number. An offer having been made by the church Brattle, that the meeting house and the use of the convention and committee having viewed the accommodations, it was voted that when the convention do adjourn, it adjourned to meet at 3 o'clock at the meeting house in Brattle Street. So now they're moving to Brattle Street, to this church. Anyway, Friday the 11th, and then there's just a couple things that happen, and then Saturday the 12th. I mean, you're seeing all this, Paul, right? I mean, they're just kind of boom, 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 and they're skipping over a lot of little things that they're not covering. They're only documenting these little things that the convention is doing regarding the ratification debates.
Correct.
And so it kind of goes on and on and on, and I'll let you go ahead and pick up on Monday, January 14th, because they just really, I don't think they did much, because they don't say much on Saturday. But go ahead, because I think this is where they get into some meat.
Okay. Monday, January 14th.
Oh, you know what? No, you know, Paul, I just looked at the clock, and believe it or not, the show's over. And what? So we got 8 seconds left. Folks, we're going to have Paul back tomorrow. And this is where we're going to pick up on Monday, January 14th. So thank you so much, Paul. I hate to cut you off, but the music's already playing over me and you. So anyway, folks, we will be back in our next episode, and we will be beginning the Massachusetts ratification debates. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Moby Strip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Moby Strip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you.